The Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd Legislature will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Fraser.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Russell. Representative Russell. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller, present.
Representative Novotny.
Body present.
Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raley.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vaughn.
Vang, present.
Representative Sean.
Sean, present.
Members, I believe we have a quorum. I suspect some of the members who aren't here will probably cycle in at some point. That's pretty typical. And so I'd ask the clerk to keep an eye out and always encourage members just to, alert us when they do come in. You've probably noticed, no doubt, that our clerk is a different person today. In fact, it's a new person. I want to welcome Mr. Abdul Abdullahi, who will be our committee legislative assistant during this session. Some of you know that Caitlin Alunfolami has left our employee at the House, much to our loss, but also much to Hennepin County's tremendous gain. I'm really looking forward to working with Abdul, if you can just very quickly tell us, give us your name, where you went to school, where you live, anything just really quick could be great.
Thank you so much, Chair. My name is Abdullahi. I went to the school at the University of Minnesota. I graduated in May. I was working on a city council campaign in Ward 11, and I was blessed to get the opportunity to come work here.
And as I outed him, a few days ago, he was a poli-sci major over at the University of Minnesota, the Gophers. But more importantly, he minored in philosophy. So he's a man after my heart. So welcome, Aldo. I really look forward to working with you. This hearing is being conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing members to debate and vote by means of distant voting, remote electronic voting, or other means to allow legislative operations while preserving the safety of the public, staff, and members. The hearing may be viewed via the House webcast. The link is on the committee website page, and those interested in testifying can email the committee administrator, Jamal Lundy, 24 hours before a hearing. Email is also found on the committee website page. I want to welcome back our members, and I trust you each and all had a restful, productive interim, including a peaceful and safe holiday season. Just a very quick pause. Within the hour, we heard some disturbing news of some gun violence, public safety incident in the Edina Richfield area, I think perhaps more Richfield involving a school. Our thoughts, no doubt, and hopes and prayers for people's safety comes out from every member of this committee to that community. and also to those who have been victimized in particular. And of course, always grateful and thankful for our law enforcement community professionals who are on the scene, even as we speak now. Representative Edelson, you're probably the community closest to what's happening. When I exchanged some quick texts just a little while ago. I believe this might involve Representative Howard's district. And I think you've been in touch with him. And so at any point in which you receive or hear anything, you know, feel free to chime in and you know, help us all keep posted on what's going on.
Thank you, Chair. It was District 287 in Richfield on Penn. And so I've been in contact. I'm trying to connect with the superintendent, but law enforcement is on the scene, and it's a tragic thing. So thank you for acknowledging that.
You bet. Members, this is, and Representative Johnson, when I'm through with these quick intros, I'm just going to ask you if you want to just issue a few thoughts and comments. And actually, I see your hands up as well, so I'll call on you in a short minute here. I just want to get these, you know, first committee preliminaries out of the way quickly. As members know, this is our short session, and so the chair will do his best to keep us moving through a very full agenda, as this committee is charged with overseeing a broad scope of public safety, corrections, and emergency management systems. So I've chaired other committees before, but the scope and of this committee is really pretty incredible and vitally important to the people of Minnesota. So we have a lot of ground to cover, even in short sessions. I'm going to ask for each member's collaboration to help the committee move efficiently through the many bills and debates that we no doubt will be having in the weeks to come. This week, we will hold three hearings. It is my intention not to have three hearings next week. We won't be doing that. And hopefully, we can preserve the Friday optional day as much as we can. Obviously, toward the end of session, that becomes a much more difficult thing. And of course, you know, a week from this Friday takes us right into Valentine's Day and the Super Bowl. So it's pretty important for all sorts of reasons for folks to be able to have that kind of time. But it's also, you know, good prep time for members. So I'll try to be as respectful as I can with that. It's really going to depend on how efficient we are with the other two hearings that we have regularly scheduled on our Tuesdays and also on our Thursdays. As you all know, I try to order our work around themes so that the public can track what we do easily. This first week is Public Safety Innovation Week, and today is dedicated to Increasing Law Enforcement Partnerships Day. We will hear House File 2724, Representative Frazier's bill, with a focus on Article 1. We will hear the other articles on Thursday and Friday. It's a comprehensive bill, and so we're going to spend upfront time delving into that. These are informational hearings only, so we will not be moving this bill. We will lay it over for later action, including possible amendments, et cetera. We'll begin today's hearing by hearing from House Research, providing a summary of Article 1, and we'll hear from testifiers. The chair is going to hold questions until after the testifying. I'll try to do that in two chunks during our hearing. And again, I would ask members to be brief in their inquiries. Before I call on Representative Frazier, our vice chair, I'd like to call on our minority lead and former chair of this committee, Representative Brian Johnson.
Chair Mariani, thank you for letting me speak this morning. As the tragic incident, I don't know a lot of information yet. I'm still trying to gather information on the tragedy at that school. I just want to say our hearts and prayers are out to the families that live in that community, that have children there. As I would ask people at law enforcement do what they need to do to make sure everybody is safe and to do a proper investigation, whatever the incident is, and give it time. These types of investigations do take a lot of time. we want to make sure we get every, they want to make sure that they, everything is done properly and correctly to hold those individuals accountable that are involved in this. Another thing I wanted to mention that Representative Grossel, I've asked that he'd be excused. He has a medical appointment. As you know, this right now with the situation of the hospital, it's a little tough getting appointments. You have to take them whenever you can. And I'd also ask that Representative Mary O'Neill is tied up on issues that she'd also be excused. I also am a little disappointed that the very first week we're already having committee meetings on Friday as they were only as needed. And it's sort of hard to think that the very first week it's as needed. I'm hoping that we do not have many, if any, on Friday until the very, maybe at the very, very end before deadline, as we will have a lot of our members, we have members that live a long distance away, do need to go home to their constituents to talk to them, find out what their issues are and where they stand on some of the things we're talking about. So I'm gonna ask that we try to avoid the Friday committee hearings as much as possible. I have to cancel one appointment I already had today at this time period to be here. So, and I'm looking forward to our conversation after the meeting.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. A couple of things very quickly. You know, I think, obviously you're feeling pretty strongly about, hearing the news today. And I think it's appropriate that your counsel about, how we approach this is good. Obviously, it comes from your own experience, having served the public, no doubt, as a law enforcement official. I've had some pretty tragic incidents occur in my district, this summer that I hit pretty close to home in terms of involving individuals in my extended family that were present during some horrific violence. And so it's just a reminder of just how critically important public safety is to each and every one of us and how personal it absolutely is. One of my blessings is to be able to chair this committee chock full of people who are mature and serious about their commitment to fundamental duty of government to help keep us all safe. And Representative Johnson, I will absolutely work as hard as I can to avoid those Friday hearings. No promises because you know how this place is, but I will certainly try to honor that as much as possible. With that, members, we're going to move into the agenda. And so I'm going to ask Representative Frazier to come forward. And Representative Frazier, I believe your motion before us is to move that House File 2724 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The chair will be laying this bill over toward the end of our hearing. Representative Frazier, let me know if that's your motion and we'll get moving.
That is my motion, Chair.
Very well. Representative Frazier so moves House File 2724 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair Lee Johnson and committee members. Welcome to the first week of session that we're calling Public Safety Innovation Week in this committee. This week, we'll be discussing House File 2724, the Public Safety Innovation Package. Developed in response to the national rise in crime we've seen sweep across Minnesota, I think every member on this committee can agree that combating this national crime wave should be the number one priority for this committee, as it is a top priority for policymakers across the country. This bill was brought together over several months using a simple nonpartisan process in hopes that amidst the national crisis, Minnesotans can come together to support research-based solutions to combating crime. As we underwent this process, we asked experts, impacted people, and law enforcement a simple question. What is the best evidence-based solutions to combating crime? Then we put our politics aside and placed those solutions in this bill. As you will see this week, the answers we received from experts, victims, and even law enforcement prompted this bill's focus on preventing and solving crime, opposed to focusing solely on punishing crime, because preventing and solving crime have a more immediate effect on crime and precede the sentencing stage. With that said, I want to be clear, that doesn't mean accountability isn't vital. Every member of this committee can agree that if you commit a crime, you should be held accountable. And we have supported increasing accountability as recent as last year when necessary. However, our decades-long focus on combating crime in the courtroom through tough sentencing has caused us to neglect more effective ways of combating crimes in police precincts by investing in increasing clearance rates or combating crime in our local neighborhoods by investing in building community confidence in law enforcement and funding crime prevention programs. This bill will not make the same mistake. Over this week, we will talk about how we can address this national crime wave impacting Minnesota by passing the Public Safety Innovation Package, a toolkit for cops and communities that invest $100 million in increasing law enforcement partnerships, increasing law enforcement capacity by providing funding for more effective law enforcement, and increasing community confidence, which translates into increased community crime reporting. Today, we are here to discuss Article 1 of House File 2724, the Public Safety Innovation Package. This portion of the bill focuses on increasing law enforcement partnerships. As you will hear today from Dr. Sharkey, crime prevention program investments are effective. They could have an immediate impact and are essential to sustainable safety. This article of the bill looks to make these investments by innovating the way we distribute violence prevention, by distributing state resources based on local geographic needs, opposed to distributing grants statewide based on the issue area it addresses. The hope is that we can have neighborhoods impacted by crime able to direct state resources towards solutions to crime in their neighborhood. The effect of crimes we are all concerned about often don't fit neatly in a singular box labeled juvenile delinquency, domestic violence, or homelessness, which is why this provision offers $40 million in grants to be used to combat a myriad of social ills that lead to crime. Finally, this money is made permanent because it is imperative that these types of programs must become a fixture of our public safety framework instead of causes of the moment. I will allow staff to provide a technical overview, but before that, I want to emphasize the importance of these hearings and the importance of feedback from stakeholders throughout this process. The purpose of this week is to publicly hear feedback from stakeholders on ways we can improve this bill. We intend on using that feedback to improve this bill and bring it back to the committee for further consideration. This process is already underway as we've received over 90 items of feedback from countless stakeholders, some of which are here today, most of which is supportive. We have already begun working to streamline the grant process and office structure to get the money out quicker to where it is needed based on feedback from DPS. We are also already looking at changing the grant advisory board membership to ensure victim advocate involvement in alignment with local municipalities' public safety goals based on input from impacted people in cities. Similarly, we are committed to increasing the funding amount for body cameras based on the input we receive from law enforcement. We will continue to take feedback on this bill over the next several weeks and craft the final product that reflects the wide variety of stakeholders we'll engage with over the next coming months. I'm confident that after this process, we will have a package that will provide a public safety framework that responds to this national moment, matches the scale of the challenge before us, and will begin to turn the tide of this national crime wave's impact on Minnesota. With that, Chair, I turn to staff.
Very well, thank you for that introduction, Representative Frazier. And I believe Mr. Johnson will be walking us through. I think the intent here, hope I stated it correctly, Representative Frazier, is to have Mr. Johnson walk us through Article 1 of the bill, as that'll be the focus of today's conversation. Is that correct?
That is correct, Chair.
Very well. Mr. Johnson, good to see you again. And please take us through Article 1 of House File 2724.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to walk through Article 1. Article 1 has four sections in it. Section 1 establishes the Office of Public Safety Innovation within the Office of Justice Programs. The new office would have a director and staff who would have responsibilities, including identifying targeted areas. Those are areas with a combination of low average incomes and high crime rates. The director and staff would coordinate with local groups to establish priorities for grants to nonprofit organizations. The grants can be in any of eight different categories. The section would require each targeted area to receive at least $5 million for grants, and limit individual grants to no more than $1 million a year. Two-thirds of the money must be distributed within the metropolitan area and one-third outside that area. The section requires the director of the new office to establish community grant advisory boards within those targeted areas. After a direct mail survey, those community grant advisory boards provide notice of the grants, accept applications, and make recommendations for funding. This section also requires a report on each grant issued under this particular section of law, and directs the Office of Justice Programs to contract with an independent third-party vendor to conduct evaluations on the effectiveness of the programs provided by each recipient. Section 2 appropriates $40 million in fiscal year 23 for the grants that are issued under Section 1, and then sets a base of $10 million a year on an ongoing basis. It specifies that grant funds may not be used to administer the grants. Section 3 appropriates an unspecified amount to establish and maintain the Office of Public Safety Innovation. And finally, Section 4 transfers $10 million in fiscal year 23 to the Opiate Epidemic Response Fund for prevention and education efforts. Mr. Chair and members, that is all of Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that concise and good summary of Article 1. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll next turn to Dr. Patrick Sharkey.
Very well. Welcome, Dr. Sharkey. You and I don't think we've met. Perhaps we have, but I don't think so. I understand that you're a sociology professor at Princeton, that little school somewhere here in the United States, and that you have a pretty extensive background on the issues that this bill will be, that speaks to. So welcome to our committee today. We look forward to your insights from as a researcher and someone whose gaze is cast across, no doubt across the nation as different jurisdictions respond to and act proactively for criminal justice and preventing crime. Mr. Sharkey.
Thanks so much, Chair Mariani and Representative Frazier for having me here. And it's good to see everyone. I'm sorry to hear about the news of what's gone on there. It reflects a core idea that I'm going to talk about and that I've been researching for the past decade or so, which is the full toll of violence. I'm here because over the past decade, I've carried out research on the consequences of violence, and that has led me to the very clear conclusion that violence should be seen as the fundamental challenge of urban areas. And the reason I've come to that conclusion is because of the growing body of evidence that has shown that violence can't just be understood in terms of lives lost. Violence undermines entire communities. It affects the educational and the economic trajectories of young people. It affects the likelihood that families will invest in neighborhoods, that teachers will invest in school districts, that business owners will set up shop in a community and stay there. So the very idea of city life breaks down when public spaces are unsafe. Now, there in Minnesota, you've seen a really stunning rise in gun violence over the past 2 years, which reflects a larger shift that has occurred across the country, and that has been really, that began several years ago, really in 2014. That was a point at which violence started to rise. So the question then is how to respond. And I think the first step is to think about how we have responded in the U.S. And drawing on the work of a large number of historians, I think I've come to the conclusion that since the 1960s, our nation's primary response to the challenge of violence and the broader challenge of extreme urban inequality has been to turn to the police and the prison system. So the first point that I want to make is this. Relying on the police to be the primary institution responsible for public safety can be effective in reducing violence, but it can also come with great costs, and it is extremely unfair to law enforcement. So let me unpack that statement a little bit. We have very strong evidence that when more police are on the street, violent crime falls, okay? And that evidence comes from a whole bunch of different empirical approaches, including experimental studies as well as natural experiments. But this approach also creates substantial harm. That harm comes in the form of intensive surveillance of low-income communities, it comes in the form of mass incarceration, and it comes in the form of aggressive and sometimes violent policing. And we all watched the most extreme example of what that can look like in the video of George Floyd's murder, but it's a larger phenomenon. One out of every 1,000 Black men and boys will be killed by law enforcement over the course of their lives. 1,000 people are killed by the police every year, and despite the scrutiny, the attention that we've seen to police shootings over the past 7 years, that number has not fallen at all. Lastly, law enforcement has been given the extremely unfair task of solving all of the problems that come with urban inequality, which includes problems ranging from homelessness, addiction, substance abuse, more generally mental illness. This is extremely unfair to put all these challenges on one institution where there is not sufficient training, sufficient resources to adequately respond to the range of problems that come when you have concentrated disadvantage, concentrated poverty. So this leaves us with two questions. How can we develop policy to end the wave of violence that you've seen in Minnesota that has happened across the country over the past 2 years, but really over the past 7 or 8 years? And secondly, how can we do so with a new model that doesn't come with the harm that can arise from aggressive policing and mass incarceration? So this brings me to my second key point. There is now a large body of evidence demonstrating that residents and local community organizations can play a central role in keeping communities safe. So my understanding is that you will hear how this happens from the people actually doing this work on the ground in these meetings. I'm going to give you the quantitative perspective, okay? So I carried out a national analysis with three graduate students to estimate the causal impact of local nonprofit organizations on violent crime, specifically organizations that were formed to deal with violence directly, but also organizations that provided community centers, mentorship programs, after school programs, organizations that were formed to build stronger communities. We found that in a typical city of 100,000 residents, every 10 additional nonprofit organizations led to a 9% reduction in the murder rate. This finding is reinforced by a growing number of studies using randomized controlled trials to evaluate the work of nonprofits that are working against violence. A couple examples. The Becoming a Man program in Chicago incorporated cognitive behavioral therapy plus after-school sports programs. It reduced arrests among the young people who took part in the program by 45 to 50%. Redesigning abandoned plots of land in Philadelphia. Again, these plots of land were randomly assigned to be green, to be redeveloped and beautified. Redesigning abandoned plots of land reduced violence by 29% in high poverty neighborhoods. Improving lighting around housing developments in New York City reduced nighttime felonies by 36%. Summer jobs programs and youth programming, again in Chicago, but there are other studies in New York, including one that just came out. This program in Chicago reduced violence among those participating by 43% over the subsequent 16 months. So these findings reflect a larger conclusion. Residents and local organizations have always had the capacity to control violence in their own neighborhoods, but they have never been seen as a primary institution, the primary set of people responsible for dealing with violence. They've never been given the commitment or the resources to do so in a sustained way. So the third and last point I'll make is this. When you rely on police officers to be the central set of actors responsible for public safety, and then they pull back from that role, you will frequently have a rise in violence, such as what we've seen in Minneapolis and in many other cities since the summer of 2020. What I find most compelling about this bill is that it represents an investment in a different set of actors to play a more central role in creating safe, strong neighborhoods. But it is also an investment in a new style of policing that can build trust and make the police more effective. So it is this combination of investments that I see as essential to reducing violence. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sharkey. I trust that you are able to stick around because we're going to do a question after we hear from a couple of other
testifiers.
Very well. And I've got questions myself, and I no doubt so do several other members. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your work of studying and helping to inform policymakers of what you're gleaning from those on-the-ground studies. Next, we're going to hear from Guadalupe Lopez from Violence Free Minnesota. Ms. Lopez is the executive director of Violence Free, and I believe newly appointed to that position. So congratulations to you, Ms. Lopez. You will be, I think, accompanied by someone from MnCASA as well. We'll see how that plays out. But at any rate, welcome to the committee, Ms. Lopez. Please state your name for the record, and please provide us with your testimony.
Hello, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. I'm Guadalupe Lopez, Executive Director with Violence Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse. We are a statewide coalition with over 90 member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victims, survivors in all of Minnesota 87 counties. I'm testifying today in support of the Committee Safety Innovation Grants House File 2724. We are thrilled to see victim service providers included as eligible grantees. Domestic violence programs have a direct and immediate impact on the public safety of Minnesotans. These advocacy programs work to prevent violence, provide intervention, and facilitate healing in the aftermath of violence. For the past 3 years, we have informed our elected officials of the growing needs of victim survivors across the state. And we have advocated for increased funding to address the needs of victim survivors and the children and the gaps of funding experienced by violence-free Minnesota member programs. The pandemic has only made the situation worse as need has grown for funding, gaps expanded. Our advocacy programs continue to report record numbers of people reaching out for services, and those who reach out to services are reporting more severe violence, complex family needs, and increased mental health issues. In 2001, at least 26 Minnesotans were killed during intimate partner violence. Most recently, conflict stemming from an intimate partner violence spilled onto the largest public shooting in St. Paul, recent history at the Truck Park Bar, killing Markeisha Wiley, an innocent bystander. Intimate partner homicide is the most extreme version of relationship abuse and has a direct impact on individuals, families, and community safety. We will not see a reduction in violent crimes or an increase in safety if we do not recognize the impact of domestic violence to public safety in our communities. In order to end relationship abuse in Minnesota, we must make a broad, sustained investments in prevention. Prevention includes safe, affordable housing and pathways towards financial stability alongside with community education and healthy relationship trainings to youth to prevent violence from happening in the first place. Prevention is also includes programming to transform abusive behaviors and to end the cycle of violence. In order to transform the landscape of violence in Minnesota, we must address repeat violence by providing funding for domestic abuse transformation programming, restorative justice, and other programs to change abusive behavior. Victim survivors continuously request accountability and services for those who use violence in hopes and change of behavior, and that the abuse stops, not only for them, but for the children and for any future victims. Until there is an investment in change perpetrators' behavior, there will always be another victim. Domestic violence will continue. Violence Free Minnesota is also supportive and inclusive restorative justice and programming as eligible grantees in this bill, as this work is taking place in Minnesota and in the context of domestic and sexual violence. And it is an important tool for victim-centered accountability and healing after experiencing abuse. When victim survivors of domestic and sexual violence reach out for shelters or services for themselves and their children, victim advocates must be present to meet a variety of needs during the incredible, frightening time of crisis. Advocates continue to provide these essential in-person services during the additional crisis of COVID-19 pandemic. In order to meet these demands of this moment, our elected officials must invest in community-based advocacy services for victims, survivors of domestic and sexual violence. In addition to our support for victim services and community safety innovation grants, we ask that the state legislature to invest $15 million annually to increase base funding to crime victim services this legislative session, so survivors can access services and supports they need to care for themselves and their children. This funding is supported by each of the 5 statewide coalitions working to end violence and abuse: Violence Free Minnesota, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, Minnesota Alliance on Crime, Mending the Sacred Hoop Coalition, and the Minnesota Indian Women Sexual Assault Coalition. Our request for funding covers a variety of needs for victim survivors and the families, include funding for community-based advocacy services for victim survivors of domestic and sexual violence, child abuse, and general crimes. Our member programs need to increase their levels of advocacy to meet the identified needs across the state. There is particularly great need for culturally specific programming. Prevention funding aimed at stopping the cycle of violence in our communities. Ending domestic violence requires investment in prevention. With funding, we can promote community education and healthy relationship training to prevent violence from happening. We also need to address the repeat violence by providing funding for domestic abuse transformation programming, restorative justice, and other programs to change offender behavior to end the destructive cycle of domestic violence. We needed ongoing financial investment into the work by the legislature to expand community programs that have long waiting lists and are not available in all areas of the state. Finally, in this funding request, includes direct client assistance funds to allow our survivors of crime to have immediate access to safety and allow them to meet the basic needs for themselves and their children. Replacing broken doors, assisting relocation costs, paying for uncovered mental health and health costs are critical keys for safety. We are urging your support for substantial funding that will sustain and expand critical public safety operations for crime victim services. Domestic violence programs have a direct and immediate impact on public safety of Minnesotans. We need your continued commitment to prioritize the safety of survivors, their children, and all our communities across the state of Minnesota. Chimiigwech. Thank you.
Thank you, Executive Director Lopez. And you spoke to an incident that, in fact, happened in my community, my district, and it was very upfront and personal for me and my extended family. One of the best friends of Miss Wiley was at our home over the holidays, and still reeling and suffering from the incredible trauma and loss of her dear friend. I had several young men that basically grew up in my home who were there that evening, and about 4. Very real work. The frame that Violence Free uses, I think, is very powerfully informative in terms of changing offender behavior, to break cycles, restorative services to break cycles, and always supporting those who are survivors of crime, so that that could also help to break the cycle. So thank you for your work and your words, and hopefully you could also stay for questions that we'll get to shortly. With that, Representative Fraser, we have Ms. Jessica DeWeert, and if I mispronounce that, please correct me, who is a co-chapter leader of the Minnesota chapter of MONS Demand Action for Common Sense in America. Ms. DeWeert, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Hi, thank you. And thank you for acknowledging what's going on in Richfield right now. We never, unfortunately, you never really adjust to hearing about these stories. And I'm also very appreciative of the work that Executive Director Lopez does throughout Minnesota. So my name is Jessica DeWeert, and I am the state chapter co-lead of Moms Demand Action here in Minnesota. For those that don't know, Moms Demand Action is a grassroots movement of Americans fighting for public safety measures that can protect people from gun violence. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 2724. And thank you, Representative Fraser, for bringing this important bill that creates an Office of Public Safety Innovation and the opportunity to reimagine public safety in Minnesota through the funding of community violence interrupters and co-responder dispatch teams through the efforts of sustainable annual grants. The initiatives that would be supported by the Community Safety Grants Program are data-informed and community-based. These programs operate at the unique intersection of community and city-led public safety and can, with the proper resources, effectively engage those driving the majority of gun violence in our state. Gun violence continues to be a problem in our communities, and the past 2 years have been especially challenging in cities like Minneapolis, where I live. Thankfully, there's a growing body of evidence as to what community organizations, leaders, and municipalities do to prevent these daily acts of community gun violence that disproportionately impact communities of color in our cities. Violence intervention and prevention programs have demonstrated that violence can be reduced when we identify and target those interventions and prevention strategies in those segments of the population at the highest risk for involvement in gun violence. By funding this public health approach and targeting the hardest hit communities across our state and empowering those municipalities most affected, we can keep our communities safer from gun violence. And we know it works. Local gun violence intervention groups have been and continue to do life-saving work on the front lines in our communities with very little resources. Now is the time to expand and sustain the support for those programs, to drive down the rising gun violence rates and provide the critical support needed for those most at risk at harm so that they can lead safe lives. I urge everyone to support this important bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. DeWeert, for your testimony and also for your work. You know, something you said really resonated with me from a recent conversation I had with several of my St. Paul colleagues, with our local leaders, including our chief of police, Chief Todd Axtell. And one of the things he spoke about was this work of identifying and targeting. We went through a rash of, we still have, but pretty heightened last year of carjackings involving guns. While that's still a problem and an issue, working across different sectors in terms of identifying and targeting their resources, both to communities and to individuals who have been identified, they're having an impact. So I think really good counsel here. Members, we're going to pause now for from the testimony to take questions. And we're actually running pretty well on time, so I'm hoping that we can have a good 15 minutes of engagement with our testifiers here today. And so I will open up the floor for our members. I'll watch for the hands function on the participation list. If I don't call on you, I yell out, I do see Representative Mueller. I have to say, Representative Mueller, you know, we finally got to meet each other face-to-face on the House floor last year when we had our omnibus bill here. And embarrassingly, I'm like, who are you? But that's what happens, you know, unfortunately, with this, you know, this format. But it was a real pleasure to meet you in person, and thank you for your work and your community with young people as well that was manifested in our bill. Representative Mueller, your question.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and likewise, a pleasure to meet you in person as well. I did have a question for Dr. Sharkey, and my question was, I was wondering some of the statistics that you had cited, where can I find this research? Is there a write-up someplace that I can review as well? I was reading, I'm a former teacher, and well, you're never a former teacher, but I'm a teacher, and I've been taking some notes, and there's just some statistics that you had rattled off that I you know, were new to me, and that's great, but I just was wondering if there you could direct me to some sources, or if you had a handout that I could review, that would be great. Thank you.
Dr. Sharkey.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I think maybe Chair Mariani, you can just let me know the most efficient way to get the documentation out to everybody. I could certainly send slides, you know, from when I talk about this kind of stuff, or I can send, you know, links to the actual studies. Whatever is most useful, I'm happy to just after the meeting, I'll send out what's most useful.
Perhaps the best way to do that might be just to forward that to our committee administrator, Janelle, who you've interacted with. And then I'm tasking him as we're speaking here to make sure that all members, you know, receive that. I'm just wondering really quickly, just piggybacking on Representative Mueller, and I'll come back to you as well, Representative Mueller. But, you know, if you had to typify kind of like what the big learnings, and maybe you've already articulated, but it's okay to reemphasize, what the big learning is in terms of how our studies are helping to evolve our understanding. So what has evolved in terms of our understanding of violence prevention, inputs, effectiveness, et cetera?
Yeah, there has been quite a bit of change in terms of the quality of the evidence that has surfaced over, I'd say, the past 20 years. And that evidence, you know, I mentioned that there's very good evidence that more police on the street reduces violence. And so, you know, I say that and get a lot of pushback. We have really good evidence of that. And it comes from natural experiments that lead to situations where when police forces are bolstered, there's less violent crime. There's also the set of consequences that I discussed. But then there is, you know, people who are doing the work on the ground knew this. But over the past 10 years, there have been a bunch of efforts to evaluate programs providing after school, providing outreach services or violence interrupter programs, providing summer jobs to young people that where they've actually done the work to carry out a formal randomized controlled study randomly assigned half of the eligible people to take part and half to not take part. So that's the gold standard of evidence. And that, I'd say in the past 10 years, a series of these studies have been published, reinforcing what I think people doing on the ground have known for a long time, that when there are local organizations that are professional, that are well-funded, that have high-quality programs, they have an enormous capacity to reduce violence in their communities. We've just never thought of those groups and those actors as being the primary people to turn to reduce violence. But the evidence base that has emerged has just become so strong, and it has made it very clear that we should be thinking of these groups as central to the effort to reduce violence. We have a knee-jerk reaction to turn to the police, and I'm not saying we should turn away from the police, but I'm saying we should start to think about this other set of actors as having that capacity to really play a central role to reduce violence.
And Dr. Sharkey, how essential, if at all, is it in your, in your review of empirical evidence, how essential is it for, for traditional, if you will, policing and these kind of efforts to coordinate with one another? Is that being measured as being effective, or has it been looked at, or is it a thing?
Yeah, there are a few examples of what is called problem-oriented policing that I think provide the best example of what it looks like when law enforcement is interacting closely with residents and groups on the ground to solve problems, to figure out which spaces in a community are spaces where robberies are taking place, or are spaces that become problem areas at a certain time of day or day of the week. And again, there's really high quality evidence showing that when police are working closely with residents and organizations to do their work, when they built the trust with residents, when residents know that police have their best interests in mind, then they can be extremely effective. So there are some organizations, I have to say that, where it might undermine their mission if they're too closely linked in with the police. There are examples of organizations where, if people are really going to trust what they're doing, they're going to want to know that they're not working hand in hand with law enforcement. And that's particularly true in communities where the level of trust between residents and the police has just deteriorated to a degree where residents really don't want anything to do with local police officers. But for the most part, if community organizations are working directly with the police, and I could give a bunch of examples of proofs of concept of how this has worked, then that provides the best potential for community organizations to do their job effectively and for law enforcement to actually improve the efficiency of their work as well.
Thank you, Dr. Sharkey. We'll look for that information that you'll provide. Thank you, Representative Mueller, for inquiry, making that inquiry. We have three members, Representative Novotny.
Hey, Chair Mariani. My question is for Mr. Sharkey. You stated several times that there is, sorry, my dog just jumped up. So you stated several times that there's working with the police, these community agencies working with the police. So much of what we've seen in the direction for the last couple of years has been working instead of the police. Do you know of any agencies or any communities where the instead of has worked?
Working instead of the police, is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Dr. Sharkey.
Sure. So, the answer is yes. There are examples where, the community organizations have taken on the central role. And just to, I think one kind of proof of concept, and it was a very short initiative, just 5 days in Brooklyn in, I think it was in 2021, but it was called 5 Days Without Cops. Now, the reality is cops were a part of this program, but it was essentially an effort to set up shop in around a housing development that was a frequent site of violence. And it wasn't anarchy. It wasn't an autonomous zone. It was community organizations who set up shop and said, okay, we're going to see what happens when residents know that we're here to look out for everybody in this public space, to make sure everybody's safe without the help of police officers. Police officers were nearby. It wasn't like they were nowhere to be found. If there was an incident of gun violence, if an arrest needed to be made, police officers were nearby. What happened in those 5 days is not a single call for service occurred in that area, except for one, which was a mistake from a bus driver who mistakenly called 911. So in those 5 days, residents of the community recognized that it was a chance for them to show that this community could be safe without the direct presence of police officers patrolling the neighborhood, with community organizations out visible in public space and making sure that if people needed help, they could come to them. Again, police were nearby, but they were not the primary actors responsible for public safety in that community. So this is not a long-term program. This is just a proof of concept, but that might be the kind of example that might answer your question.
Thank you. If you could send me that information, I'd like to. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chair.
No, go ahead, Representative Lottie, please.
Oh, thank you. If you could cite that, I'd like to study it and see how big the area was that you were talking about. And if you're going to be citing New York, most of us are familiar with the Broken Windows campaign that took place under the Giuliani administration, was very similar to what was done in Minneapolis in the 90s, going from 100-ish murder rate down to 30s. And not to say that 30 is an acceptable number, but it's a lot less than 100. Long-term, if you go 2 years without having 100 homicides in your city, that's 70 arrests that you don't have to make for a murder. Long-term, has Bernie and been any studies on the effect of like a Broken Windows campaign, be it Minneapolis or New York, where it started, on total incarceration rates? If we drastically bring down the violent crime rate, wouldn't that extrapolate out to less incarceration?
Quickly, Dr. Sharkey, then we're going to move to Representative Long. Dr. Sharkey.
Well, what I'd say is over the nation, over the long term, falling violence has not translated into less incarceration. As violence fell from the 1990s through the early 2010s, the incarceration rate rose, and it rose substantially. So, the incarceration rate has fallen since that point, since the beginning of the 2010s. But I guess I would challenge the idea that falling violence necessarily leads to falling rates of incarceration. It can happen via policy change. We've seen it. We saw it happen over the past 6 years in New York. As violence fell in New York, the rate of incarceration fell substantially as well. But I don't think it's an automatic relationship.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Long.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to first thank Jessica Dorth for being here and for the incredible advocacy that Moms Demand Action does on behalf of preventing violence in our state and in our communities, and sending our thoughts and well wishes to Richfield and to the many survivors of gun violence for whom these events are re-victimizing. I had two questions for Professor Sharkey. The first is that I represent a district in Minneapolis, and we have certainly had a rough few years. And the trust level between police and community is not high in our city. And that's, I think, a real challenge for having effective policing and solving crimes. And I'm curious for the sort of, you, I think, put it well, that this bill has a combination of working with community groups and working with effective policing. And I'm wondering if you know of research or other evidence that both those types of proposals, having community groups get funding and also having the type of community-oriented policing that this bill proposes can rebuild trust between police and community.
Trust issues, Dr. Sharkey, quickly.
It's a great question, and I think there are efforts to rebuild trust with police departments that are going on across the country. I don't know that we have a sufficient evidence base to know whether that, particularly in communities that have experienced harm over a long period of time, whether trust can be rebuilt. What I will say is that there is evidence that police departments can change how they do their work and how they interact with residents, and violence can fall. I go back to New York because I was at NYU for 10 years, and so when I was there, I was very familiar with what was going on in the city and what was going on in the NYPD. What happened in New York over time is that as the police departments ended the practice of stop, question, and frisk, which had grown out of control under Mayor Bloomberg, as the police department ended that practice and started to employ what they called neighborhood coordination officers, whose job was not to enforce the law, whose job was to build trust with residents, violence kept falling. And residents slowly started to change how they perceived the police. A lot of that fell apart after the protests in 2020, to be totally honest. But there was this gradual pattern of change that occurred when the NYPD made a serious and sustained effort to change the way they did their job. It was imperfect, it was incomplete, but over that time period, violence kept falling. So I think, again, I keep saying this phrase, but I think it's a proof of concept that this type of investment, this type of effort to change the way residents and police interact while also investing in a new set of actors is the most promising path forward.
Representative Long, I think you have a second one. I'm going to ask you.
I do. It'll be very quick.
I want to get to Representative Johnson.
So my question is on the what evidence is there for increasing the length of sentences like a mandatory minimum or three strikes laws brings down crime? Professor Sharkey.
Really tough evidence base. So there's some evidence from before the 1990s. And I have to say, like, I approach this from what does the evidence tell us? I don't care how it's perceived on the left and the right. This is what the evidence tells us. Before the 1990s, there's evidence that rising incarceration did, in fact, reduce violence. After the 1990s, there's no convincing evidence that enhancing sentences or increasing incarceration reduced violence anymore. We've reached a point where the level of incarceration was so high that imprisoning that marginal offender for a longer period of time made no difference. And in fact, there's some evidence that at least treating misdemeanors as offenses that require incarceration actually makes people more likely to commit crime. So I would say since the 1990s, there's no strong evidence that increasing incarceration in any way reduces crime.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Well, Chair Mariani, I'm not sure exactly where to start. First, I want to start with Mr. Sharkey. Reference to data. The data is very important, where it came from. Unfortunately, we've had time for people nitpick the data and provide just little snippets. When you look at the entire data, that little snippet was used just to fit a area. But by looking at all the data, sometimes that little snippet, you understand it better. Also, I'd like to know if you talked about the incarceration, how lowering or raising incarceration rate doesn't seem to make a difference. Was that using Minnesota data? Or was that using nationwide data? Because Minnesota is one of the lowest incarceration rates in the country. I think we're number 48 or 49, somewhere in there. I believe it's just New Hampshire that has a lower incarceration rate than Minnesota. And we did a lot of things back in the late 70s, early 80s with our sentencing guidelines to make things more consistent and did lower our incarceration rates at that time. At that time, it was a good time. Since then, it's just we do two-thirds incarceration and one-third on supervised release. Mr. Sharkey could just be able to provide a little bit of whether your information was just strictly Minnesota or nationwide, which doesn't really apply to Minnesota.
Yeah, that's a very fair criticism. Also, all of the analysis that I'm talking about is nationwide, except for specific programs, which are in different cities. But none of it is specific to Minnesota.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for that because it does make a huge difference. Each state is different. When you talk about the incarcerations of some states, which is almost double what Minnesota has, it makes a difference. Minnesota, we do not do mass incarceration. Most of our felons are on what we call paper, on supervised release. In fact, you can do multiple burglary convictions before you even get into the State Department of Corrections facility. So we have to be careful how we talk and looking at that data, making sure it's dealing with just Minnesota data, because this is the Minnesota legislature, not the U.S. Congress. Chair Mariani, do we have any more testifiers on this bill today, or are we done?
Representative Johnson, we do. We want to hear from the Commissioner of Public Safety and then also from the Minneapolis Violence Prevention Office. I certainly do want to get their testimony in and would be willing to call on you again after that.
I would rather finish up the testimony.
Sounds good.
With everybody. And I do believe there is also another one that you didn't mention. Sheriff Tim Leslie is also supposed to testify in this bill as well. And he's in the waiting room. He is on the call today.
I will check with staff on that for sure, Representative Johnson. Thank you. And I'll call on you after those other testifiers. Representative Hollins, you're the last one. I had their hand up, and I apologize. I wonder if maybe you can hold off till we hear the other two, and I'll put you on the top of that list as well. Representative Fraser, the next part. We have testifiers, as I mentioned. Should I just go ahead and call on them at this point?
You can go ahead and call them. I did have a question for Dr. Sharkey, but I can wait till after this testimony.
Sounds good. All right. Holy cow, what happened to my list here? All right, we have someone from the... Oh my goodness.
Chair, we have Sasha Cotton from
there
Minneapolis.
There we go. Minneapolis Violence Prevention Office. Yes, thank you. Ms. Cotton.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for having me. And excuse my background. I can't seem to get it to come down, but hopefully it makes us all feel a little bit more spring-like in these winter weather conditions. So good afternoon. I am Sasha Cotton with the Minneapolis Office of Violence Prevention, where I serve as its first and only director. I've been asked to offer some testimony generally about our work and how a bill such as this might influence our work. And so I'm going to jump in because I know we're time limited here. Our office was developed in 2018, really went into activation in 2019, but our work has existed thinking about violence prevention as a public health issue in Minneapolis since around 2007 with a real focus on young people. And I think that's important to delineate because Minneapolis is not alone in that effort, although we were some of the pioneers. Since that time, offices of violence prevention or neighborhood safety have sprung up across the country. Now there are over 50, some in very large jurisdictions like New York, LA, and Chicago, but also many in smaller jurisdictions, even smaller than Minneapolis. And so it is really gaining traction. I think the information that Dr. Sharkey shared around the ways that different jurisdictions and cities across the country are trying to address this is very important that we're looking at the research. Certainly our work looks very nuclearly at what's happening at the local level and hyper-local to Minneapolis. Our office is really, in our vision, designed to complement the larger public safety system, while other systems like law enforcement and our courts are designed for accountability and to really look at how we address the problem of violence after it has occurred. Our work is designed specifically to look at how we can prevent and interrupt those incidents before they happen or at the earliest opportunity available. Oftentimes, we're able to do that work before law enforcement is involved or at the very early onsets, and certainly looking at the repeat cycle of violence. We know that people who are involved in cycles of violence are often not one-time victims or perpetrators, but their likelihood for being involved in those systems increases after they've had that initial onset. So we work hard to both interrupt and prevent initial onsets of violence, but then also working with people who have been victims or perpetrators so that they are not in a continuous cycle where violence becomes a normalized part of their life. I wanted to, of course, acknowledge the shooting that has happened in Richfield, but also highlight the fact that it gives us an opportunity to talk about some of our work, because although that incident happened and that tragedy happened in Richfield and our hearts, thoughts, and prayers go out to the victims and those impacted, the hospitals that often receive those cases are not necessarily in that locality. And our staff working in Minneapolis are in fact working with some of the victims in that case. So before I started my testimony, I've been corresponding with our leaderships in our hospital-based program known as Next Step, getting updates about that particular incident and the progress and updates on such a tragedy happening here in our local community. Our hospital-based work currently exists at HCMC, Abbott, and North Memorial, where we work with any victim who enters our hospital system with a serious injury from violence. Now, unfortunately, in our current circumstance, that often looks like shootings right now, but we are also seeing victims of serious assaults and stabbings. What we also know is that most people who come into the hospital, on average, if you come into the hospital with a serious injury from violence, you are 40% more likely than the average citizen to return to the hospital with the same or similar injury within a year of that first injury. Obviously, really speaking to this idea that violence is cyclical and that people are often repeat victims or perpetrators of violence. For folks who go through our hospital-based program, which is an initial bedside intervention to offer navigation systems through our hospitals, we know that the healthcare system can be complicated and no one arrives there expecting to become a victim of a shooting. And so the trauma that one experiences both physically and mentally are part of what we address in our hospital-based program, but also through modern medicine, people are often stitched up and sent home very quickly without much regard given to the circumstances that put that person in a vulnerable position to become a victim or how to help that person navigate reacclimating to a normal life and trying to recover not only from the physical injuries, but from the mental and emotional instability that serious injury causes. Basic needs like housing or employment can be very challenging after an experience like that. And so our case managers are working with people to help them reintegrate into society after a serious injury, but also to help them on a trajectory towards healing and away from re-injury or retaliation, which we know is often an outcome of serious injury, that what we say in our hospital-based program is hurt people, hurt people. And I did want to take just this opportunity to really focus on that hospital-based work because we are seeing the value of it in this very moment as our staff are navigating in real time the unfortunate circumstances that happened in Richfield. In addition to our hospital-based work, one of the other pieces of work that we often hear about coming out of our office that we're very proud of is our group violence intervention. And it is a strategy that is also evidence-based and rooted in national models that have been demonstrated to work at reducing violence. It's also the area where we work most closely with what people think about as a traditional public safety system. In the group violence intervention, we take referrals from probation, parole, Minneapolis Police Department, and other law enforcement agencies, as well as from the community, around people who are at greatest risk statistically for becoming the next victim or perpetrator of serious gun violence because of their involvement in group or gang violence. So we're not talking about low-level offenders. We're talking about people who are at great risk because of their history for being a victim or a perpetrator of violence. In that work, which we started in 2017, we've seen some really impressive outcomes. Of the over 400 individuals that we've provided case management and life coaching to in that program, we have only lost two to homicide. Two losses of life are dramatically unacceptable. But given the statistical outcomes for this population and the increases in shootings and homicides that we've seen in Minneapolis, the fact that these folks have been able to largely avoid death by homicide, given their high risk status, we believe is a significantly good outcome. In addition, only seven of the 400, or over 400 now, we're just over 400 participants, have recidivated in a way that would involve gun violence or send them back to incarceration. So again, really wanting to focus on the improved outcomes for people, especially as compared to someone without intervention, when it comes to both life expectancy and recidivism. And then I also just wanted to talk about the way that that lines up with law enforcement, because I think so often when folks think about offices of violence prevention or offices of neighborhood safety, the conversation around an either or comes up. But what we are really focused on in the Office of Violence Prevention in Minneapolis, and I think comprehensively across the country, and as new offices are being developed in the state, is the expansion of our public safety system. And I often liken that to the way that we think about general healthcare. If we think about the last 100 years in our general healthcare system, we have seen immense growth and a real focus on prevention. Our insurance companies even tend to focus on paying for more comprehensive prevention care because we know that there are such great cost savings and people are able to get early services, early intervention for major health outcomes and avoid the more costly services like surgery or chemotherapy for cancer. So not only do those kinds of preventative services in healthcare prevent life-altering outcomes, but they also dramatically reduce the overall cost for healthcare. And the same is true around public safety. By investing in prevention and expanding our systems, we can see great cost savings. We can also see improvements in quality of life, which we've seen in some of our preliminary work with the Office of Violence Prevention in Minneapolis, and has certainly been seen and measured in cities and jurisdictions across the country. So we feel very optimistic about what we've already seen in our work, as well as what we can produce moving forward with continued investment at the local level, and certainly great optimism for this opportunity for funding at the state level. I want to close by saying the importance of state funding could not be more important, because as we grow our work in Minneapolis, we are really learning that jurisdictions neighboring us, as in the case with Richfield, there's so significant overlap between Minneapolis, St. Paul, and its surrounding areas. And having done statewide work, grateful for Ms. Lopez's testimony as I worked for Live Free for many years, having done statewide work regionally, there's such overlap between jurisdictions oftentimes, particularly when it comes to violence and crime. And statewide work can really give us an opportunity to look at how jurisdictions overlap and increase partnerships and collaborations across regions of the state so that partners can work more comprehensively together to both create safety, create better systems outcomes, and to look at ways that we can merge our services for cost savings to really amplify the service provision and the taxpayer dollars and make sure that they're going to the best possible use. So as we've been looking at partnerships, St. Paul has just recently established its Office of Neighborhood Safety. Brooklyn Center is doing some new office-related work around developing a violence prevention plan in office. And we anticipate that jurisdictions around the metro and outstate Minnesota are going to continue to do this work, whether it's formally through offices or informally through other parts of their city and county. Funding for this kind of work is essential, especially as we see the spikes in serious violence and crime in our state. And so I am grateful that you all are taking this under consideration as we grow our work in Minneapolis and look forward to ways to work with partners across our region and throughout the state of Minnesota. And with that, I will close. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon, and I hope everyone has a great day.
Thank you, Ms. Cotton. Thank you for your testimony, and more importantly, thank you for your work and your innovative work as well. So much to say, but I do want to get our commissioner in, and so I'm going to call on Commissioner Harrington. We're hoping, of course, that the Public Safety Department will continue to interact with us in the other two hearings. So there'll hopefully be some other opportunities. But Commissioner, sorry to keep you hanging, but welcome, and I look forward to your comments.
Chairman Mariani, members of the committee, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I have not been idle while I have been waiting because we have been working, coordinating BCA and State Patrol and other resources responding to the Richfield shooting. And so that is has been a pressing matter that we've also been working on. I want to say thank you to you and the committee members for inviting me to testify today. And I want to welcome you all back to the 2022 session. And for the record, I am John Harrington. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. As Chairman Mariani knows, I spend a lot of my time working with community groups, whether it's 21 Days of Hope or Violence Free, St. Paul Intervention Project, the JCRC, Interfaith Action. And from my days in St. Paul Blue, I can tell you that we have seen community policing and community partnerships and problem-oriented policing work. And that is what I am happy to see in the testifiers today and in the work that I expect the House and the Department of Public Safety can do together to try and reduce fear and disorder within our community. In my days in St. Paul, we saw two programs that really did work quite effectively, and I just want to highlight them very briefly. One was called SAGA, Stopped Armed Gang Assaults. It was a program that was based off of the David Kennedy Boston Gun Project and Tony Braga model of reducing youth crime and youth violent crime in particular. And the other was the Boot Room for Safety, which was Praxis' version from domestic violence reduction and domestic homicide reduction based out of Duluth that we adopted in St. Paul. I can tell you, with those two programs in place, with the work of the St. Paul Police Department's Family Violence Unit, their gang unit, and the cooperation of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, we saw some of our lowest homicide rates in decades during that period when both of those programs were working together. Not only did that work then, but I can tell you that work, especially the work of SAGA, that work was carried on into UJAMA Place, a program that I helped start, where we take African-American young men coming out of correctional settings and put them into housing and get them into work, and which has resulted in a 1% or less recidivism rate for over a decade. I can tell you that we have, at Department of Public Safety, heard the public concern about the need for urgent investments in crime prevention, in crime intervention, and targeted enforcement. The community has said, and the data, really the preliminary data that we have, really confirms that we're seeing a rise in homicides, not a trivial rise. And we've seen not a trivial rise in shootings, auto crimes, and fatal crashes. All are up at a time when we have less resources, if we look at the number of cops and firefighters and EMS folks out there, than we've ever had trying to respond to those. I would argue that the time is now, and I'm just so very grateful for Representative Frazier's bill, that time is now for really to take bold steps. We're in need of a comprehensive approach to crime reduction with funding that leads to the state helping local communities and helping them to have more tools at their array. And with crime peaking, we need to work not just smarter and more comprehensively, but there is an urgency, that urgency of now, that I think we all have to feel as we are responsive to both the community's real fears and the higher incidence of crime. As I said, what I really believe we need is a comprehensive plan. It's a plan that will drive crime down and reduce the rates of victimization. And that's an area that the Department of Public Safety is particularly attuned to, with the Office of Justice Programs being the preeminent victim service agency for the state. But I also want to focus on prevention. I'm an old cop, as you know, and prevention was and remains the gold standard for prevention, for policing. If you ask a community person, would they rather have the cops catch the bad guy after the fact or never have a bad thing happen? They'll always go for not have a bad thing happen to me. It screws with your clearance rate, but it is what we all want. Nobody wants to have grandma carjacked, and nobody wants to have their mom or their sister beaten by a partner. So we do need to think seriously about how do we get ahead of the crime problem, even while we're running as fast as we can to catch up with it right now. We need a plan that provides direct support to cities and counties to meet their public safety needs. And we need to do this in a way that lets, I really believe, the locals decide what is their greatest need and what is their best method for solving it. We've heard from community and local public safety and law enforcement leaders. They know their communities best, and they've asked us to give them the tools that they know will work. And in our meetings with chiefs and sheriffs and EMS leaders, they told us what they need to be successful is resources will help recruit to put cops back on the beat, more community policing, get firefighters and EMS back on their rigs, and money for partnerships with the community, like the Stair Step Foundation and Mother's Love and CJ Jepson's Second Chance Group, to help keep the peace when cops are not the best answer to a problem. Together, we hope that we can work together to get the best and the brightest for our future firefighters, cops, and medics. But we also need more community boots on the ground. There are community crime fighters that don't wear a badge and don't wear a gun. And many of them I know work for Sasha Cotton, and we applaud their efforts. We need a smart plan too, though. It's a plan that will invest in community-based crime prevention efforts, as I said, because we all have that stake in making our community safe. And I can remember times when, whether it was the neighborhood watch in the neighborhood or the community elders at the local park, making sure that our kids were safe. And we need to see those programs that help keep youth engaged. When I was chief in St. Paul, I would tell you that my primary crime prevention partner was the library and the Parks and Rec director. Because if kids were there with good adults being driven in good areas with their coaches or their pastors or others, that kept them out of trouble, even when they weren't in school. And them being out of trouble helped keep our community safe. And we need those resources and additional resources to help reduce domestic violence and support other intervention efforts that will help lead to safer communities. This is kind of a mix, I think, in my heart. These are a mix of old ideas like community policing and walk on the beat, and new ideas like Minnesota Heals that we saw out of the Deadly Force Encounters Working Group, where we help communities come back together. It includes the smart work of David Kennedy and others like him on how to stop violent crime. And to do it, in some cases, there are times when incarceration is necessary. There are folks that are just too dangerous to be out there, and we need to be able and actively engaged in trying to make sure that we stop their ability to commit further violent crimes. But that's not the majority. And so we can't take a blanket approach to this. And I think we need to have a targeted approach. We need to take some new ideas and old ideas and blend them together like Chief Blair Anderson in St. Cloud has done with his cop houses. It builds on rebuilding or building on trust between the community that we serve and their police departments and the public safety people that are supporting them. We need a plan that helps advance 21st century approaches to policing to combat crime. And if you ask any good cop, they'll tell you they know the streets, but they don't necessarily have all of the best tools, state and regional detective teams that could help them, because crime isn't respecting borders. Jurisdictions are great on a map, but I don't have kids who are carjacking folks that stop at a border and say, oh, I have to stay within this line. We need better CSI. We need better commuters. We need better tools to help investigate our most violent crimes and help hold our repeat offenders accountable. Vice Chair Frazier, I'm going to wrap up here because I know we're running out of time. I appreciate your opening comments that you're willing to work on these processes and the languages in this bill. And we share your goal of getting money both efficiently into community, because I can tell you we've seen the need up close over the last 2 years, pushing money out, whether it's the COVID money or crime reduction money. The work we've done with Al Flowers and Lewis King, the YMCA, all have shown us the need the community has for funding. We also recognize we have an obligation to meet both state and federal reporting requirements, and that can be onerous to small community-based organizations who may not have the accountings or have the fiscal agents already in play. I'm concerned about the time and effort it may take to create a new office and staff it, and I hope that we can work together so we don't add new layers of bureaucracy to the grant process that may, in fact, slow down our ability to get much-needed funding out to where it will do the most good. I really am absolutely confident that together we will be able to find a strategy that allows us for both an efficient and a robust process, and I look forward to working with you all as we drive down the road to greater community fear, greater community safety, and less fear.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your passionate presentation. Obviously, we need lots more time. We will have more time as we continue to hear all elements of this bill, and then the bill will be laid over, and we'll come back and have more debates on it. I do want to apologize to members. It's 2:29. We're a minute away. Representative Paulson, I do see your hand. Representative Hollins and Representative Johnson, I'm going to ask Abdul to help me remember. So we'll keep you at the top of the list, you know, at the next time that we hear. I also want to acknowledge that Jamal just sent out some data that Dr. Sharkey had shared with him per Representative Mueller's inquiry. So I want to kudos to our staff, but I'm sure there'll be more forthcoming. I represent Johnson. Give me a second because I want to turn to the bill's author. And then we're going to have to make a formal motion to lay this bill over. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can hold that question that I had for Mr. Sharkey. I can circle back with him and I'll share it with the. I was going to ask him about if there's a correlation between those punitive states in terms of their incarceration rates and the rise in violence that we've seen across the nation. I'm going to ask that question, but I'll email you and then I'm going to send it. I want to share it to the group, so I'll get it to the group because I think that's an important question to ask.
That's terrific. Just to make sure I don't get cut off here, I'm going to. Formally, Representative Frazier, the chair moves to lay over House File 2724. So that bill is now laid over. We'll bring it back up on Thursday to continue the debate. Representative Johnson, you get the last few seconds here, and then we're going to adjourn.
I'm just disappointed that the sheriff sat here the entire time to testify and was not allowed to testify.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that reminder. By the way, I asked Jamel, about that. There is a letter from Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police, that they recently sent. We diligently posted that. They, in communication with them, what they said was that Sheriff Leslie was certainly here and available to testify. So he made himself available if there were questions. And so there was not an expectation that he would be offering formal testimony. However, he's certainly welcome to do that. And I suspect that might be forthcoming in the next few hearings. So I just want to make real clear that we are absolutely engaging with all stakeholders here. And I really want to appreciate Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police, as well as the rank and filers. I'm blanking on the acronym right now, who also responded to it recently as well. Those letters are posted on our website. And we'll continue this conversation with them in the coming hearings. There's a lot of room for us to do some really good bipartisan work here, Representative Johnson. I really look forward to it. We're going to need everybody's advice and wisdom, you know, putting that together.
It is disappointing that a public official has to sit here for 2 hours to testify,
Representative Johnson, please. If the sheriff had asked me to testify, I certainly would, as I always have, acknowledge that. He made himself available if there were questions. There were no questions coming forward to anyone. They've been very gracious and very accommodating and collegial with us, even as they have concerns about the bill. And I would prefer we stay focused on that, positive working together, as opposed to, you know, the misinformation that you just gave. Members, this committee stands until Thursday. This committee stands adjourned.